Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Yenji Denise, sitting in today for Catherine Cruz. We're devoting our program to the state of Hawaii's economy. What do the numbers say, and how does that compare to how people feel about their own financial well-being and that of their community? We have three experts in our studio today, and we want to hear from you. The numbers to reach us are 808-941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on the neighbor islands. Again, those numbers, 808-941-3689 here on Oahu or 877-941-3689 on the neighbor islands. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Yenji Denise, and our guests today are Paul Brubaker, economist and principal of TZ Economics, Tina Yamaki, the president of the Hawaii Retailers Association, and Mike Hamasu, researcher and consulting director at Colliers, a professional services and management company. Welcome to you all. We're so happy to have you in the studio. And of course, we are inviting our listeners to call in as well. We are talking today about our economy. And so I want to start with the economist. Paul, we think about this. First came the pandemic, then just under a year ago, those devastating wildfires in Lahaina. You couple that with high interest rates, a declining population, and a relatively softening visitor market. None of this seems very promising. So give us some broad strokes here. How are we doing?
Well, I think you made a good list of the challenges, and you're right, in particular with tourism, we're seeing the numbers organically fading this summer, on top of the wildfire legacy, which has never seen any material recovery. Sort of the numbers went down and just stayed down for the last 10 or 11 months. But that's even more true for the economy as a whole, which lost about, here in Hawaii, lost about 10% of GDP and associated, or maybe independently, about 30,000 jobs or persons, depending on how you measure it, relative to where the economy was pre-pandemic, and something more like 100,000 jobs relative to where Hawaii would have been had it stayed on the pre-pandemic trajectory. So there's some debate about what the correct benchmark is. I think of equilibrium in, you know, dynamic terms. It's the path that you want to get back to in the recovery. So we're kind of in a deep hole. Hawaii's sort of remained in a deep hole. It's growing, but from a bottom and at a speed that won't get you back to where the path we were on before the pandemic ever.
Ever.
Ever. Well, I mean, I'm doing the math in my head. I mean, I'm thinking of the picture in my head, maybe sometime in the 2030s.
Wow, that's pretty devastating. Okay, well, Tina, what are you hearing from your members? We know you represent many, many retailers across the islands. Is Hawaii a good place to do business right now?
You know, it's really hard to do business here in Hawaii because we have so many government red tapes that are going on and the taxes and all of that. But it is a place where a lot of retailers and restaurants are finding out they have like the number one busiest location in the entire nation, whether you're like a Costco or an IHOP, I think it was Starbucks, Cheesecake Factory. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. So it is a good place. We have a good mix of people. It's not only locals, but it's the visitors as well who come in. We have taken a hit with the visitors. I mean, retailers were doing strong when I started, and then we got, you know, the pandemic hit, and then we saw light at the end of the tunnel, and then it was like hard to find workers, and, you know, we got hit with higher minimum wage, and then we saw another light at the tunnel, and it was another train because it was the fires in Maui. So, I mean, it's just one hit after the other, and what we're seeing now, too, is a lot of people who normally would come to Hawaii are going to Japan. So we're missing out on those visitors, and the Japanese visitors have not come back yet either. And we all depend on that because we are tourism-based here in Hawaii.
And that's interesting that you point that out, because I think when we think about the Japanese visitor impact, we tend to think of it just solely in terms of who is not coming to Hawaii, not that people are actually choosing Japan over Hawaii. Tell me about that.
So, I mean, you ask anybody, what are you doing this summer? You know, you're calling, oh, we're going to Japan. We just came back from Japan because the yen is really good right now for us traveling over there, but not for them to come here. Their spending dollar is a lot less. So you don't have the traditional office ladies and the traditional families who come. Even during marathon, they don't bring their whole family. They just bring maybe a couple of people. So we're seeing that. And also, too, it's hit also not only us, but the hotels as well for some of them who were dependent on the Japanese visitors coming. And then, of course, in our resort areas, all those shops and things like that. Local people for us, instead of going to Vegas a lot or Disneyland this summer with the kids and family, they're all going to Japan because it's a lot cheaper. So where families used to come to Hawaii for like 2 or 3 days and go school shopping for the kids and all of that, I'm hearing that they're flying first flight in the morning and last flight out, just getting all the shopping done one time and going home.
That's so interesting. Well, let's talk about commercial real estate, and we have Mike here for that. You know, Paul talked about the shift that we've seen since the pandemic, and we know this, that a lot of people are not necessarily going into the office full time, even with back to work. I'm interested to know that workflow, what has that meant for commercial real estate?
Well, the office market has definitely been impacted. It's called a hybrid work environment where people are working remotely, or some of them are coming in, you know, certain days and living or working from home the remaining days. Occupancy levels in the office market have been hit pretty hard. We were typically ranging about a vacancy of about 10 to 12%. Now we're looking at probably 12 to 14%. But, I mean, based on what Paul and what Tina mentioned, I wanted to mention that there is some optimism out there that there is stabilization happening in the office market. You know, we tend to identify an equilibrium point of about 10% in our office market where it's vacant. Now, it's probably going to be more closer to 13, but over the past year, our vacancy rates have actually flattened out. So we're not losing any more occupancy losses. So we kind of view that as, you know, maybe this light at the end of the tunnel, or maybe the, you know, the peak has ended and we're starting to stabilize, you know. So from an office perspective, you know, on the flip side, we have continued conversions. We discussed the office conversions in a previous discussion, and that has actually helped to stabilize the office market. So fingers crossed, you know, we're hoping that, you know, maybe we've peaked in terms of vacancy and we're starting to see, you know, kind of slow down after that.
I want to bring in the callers to the conversation. We have Daniel on the Big Island who wants to share a perspective this morning. Daniel, go ahead.
Good morning. This is Daniel from Volcano calling. This is saying those who do not study history are doing repeat it. And there's a quote it is not the well-being of the individual, but the well-being of all the next is great. Niccolo Machiavelli. There has to be a social efforts for the common people to pull ourselves out of this two-class system. And the way to do that is with public bonds. And this is what Germany did in 1933. Germany was in the throes of a famine. By 1939, Germany had a higher standing of losing than the United States. The question is, how did they do that? There were two bonds, MEFO and OFA bonds, that I know of. But the point is, with public bonds, Germany became self-sufficient and basically walked away from the Treaty of Versailles, which was the unforgivable sin. This is what Churchill said about Germany. And there are two sides to that war. But for what it's worth, I think Germany is a pretty example of how to get out of a bad situation. We owe $35 trillion. My question is, what else are you going to do about it? I've had about a minute here, and I appreciate it. I'd like to have the conversation. Aloha.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Paul, I'll let you weigh in on Daniel's perspective this morning.
Yeah, you know, Nazi Germany is one of the great examples of what in economics is called autarky, which is an economy that decides to be self-sufficient. And, of course, other things didn't work out in Nazi Germany, but I'm not sure I followed the observation. Although the caller was correct that those who forget history are condemned to retweet it.
And thank you for that. Well, let's talk a little bit about government right now, because we had big news coming out of the legislature this session with some pretty major tax cuts, the highest in our history as a state. $5 billion by 2030 is the projection. What do you think the impact will be, and can we afford these tax cuts?
Well, the tax cuts, as I understand them, weren't actually designed to be self-funding. So the question of whether there's going to be enough revenue to fund the 8 years of phase-in, starting with a very small number in the current fiscal year, 40 or 50 million, and ending with 1.5 billion in foregone tax receipts. The question of how that will be made up, or whether there's a sufficient surplus available to support it, hasn't really been dealt with. But to go back to Daniel's observation, my understanding of the motivation for the tax rate reductions, income tax rate reductions, and for the increase in the standard deduction is that they were designed so that the lower income households benefited disproportionately. And it was actually a concern about the relative economic status of the lower income households that motivated the legislature to adopt the framework and for Governor Green to sign it. So whether we can find it remains to be seen. I think a lot of attention will have to be paid over the next couple of gubernatorial cycles, let's say it's an 8-year phase-in, to that question. And of course, they're constitutionally required so to do. But, the motivation was in many ways the same motivation that led decision makers to do the same thing 30 years ago in 1997, 1998 under Governor Caetano's Economic Revitalization Task Force, where again, 30 years of bracket creep, right? People's incomes go up, but the tax code hasn't changed, pushes people up into higher tax brackets. And this tax law change was designed to dial that back, especially for the lower income households.
We've got another caller on the line, but before we get to that person, Mike, I just wanted to see your thoughts on the tax cuts. I know that that's a little outside of your purview, but surely you're paying attention to it.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in a previous discussion with Seth Colby, who's the tax director, he mentioned that while it is...
Tax research director.
Tax research director, correct. All right. While it is historic, you have to also keep in mind that, the problems you mentioned about having it paid for, prior to that, we've had significant amount of surpluses in the state budget. So that money will no longer be available in the future. So ultimately, the money that you were counting on to fund a rainy day fund or face hurricanes or even wildfires will not be available. So the concern is that going forward, that could be a problem. Where you don't have a surplus to anticipate any problems in the near future.
Interesting point. Yeah. Okay, let's go to Patrick now. He's calling in from the Big Island. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. Thank you for your time. I run an SCR, a short-term rental, out of our home. It's not something that we expected to do, but we're on 3 acres, beautiful, well-maintained. We grow lots of chocolate. We're trying to grow coffee. As we're coming in into this ecotourism, it's really hard seeing that ecology has been pushed, or the environment has been pushed, to such a second front when it comes to agriculture. And tourism is number one. Tourism comes here because of the ecology, because of the environment here. And it's to the point where the Queensland beetle, the longhorn beetle, the little red fire ant, it's almost impossible to farm for a living, let alone to farm to entertain tourists. And I guess with just that pragmatism in there, I'll take my comment off the air.
Well, thank you for that, Patrick. And, it's interesting, Paul, the legislature did devote $10 million now to combat invasive species. Initially, the bill that passed was $20 million, and the governor then reduced it down to $10 million. But, what are the prospects, do you think, for this economic tourism we've heard that buzzed around that we could turn into an ecotourism state. Do you think that that's possible?
Well, the caller is correct that Hawaii's appeal has always been based on the natural and cultural endowment of the destination. I mean, that's, we don't We don't have to have gaming or prostitution to get people to come to Hawaii. But we aren't really wholesome stewards of those endowments, either the cultural or the natural resource endowment. And as a consequence, somebody who's innovatively pursuing something like what the caller described, which is known as agritourism, where, you know, city slickers like to come to where people are actually doing the farming, it's a kind of a new form of tourism. It's decentralized. It has a more rural character. It appeals to a visitor with a different kind of a preference set, a different profile from the ones that like to stay in the resorts that are essentially conurbations. And so not dealing with the environmental legacy and endowment, and not dealing with the innovation represented by somebody offering a short-term rental on agricultural land, I think is symptomatic of a broader problem of destination management and tourism governance that we really are grappling with and need to make much more progress on.
Yeah, you know, Tina, there are a lot of creative people in Hawaii with a lot of wonderful ideas on how to innovate business. What do you think, you know, you mentioned earlier hiring and some of the issues around that. What do you think is the biggest thing that's holding small business back?
There's a lot of things. Number one is, you know, we're coming up again on increase in a minimum wage, you know, and we all know that nobody can pay it at that point, you know. Everyone's expecting that $2 increase, even if you are making $20 an hour now. So smaller businesses have a harder time competing and getting people. They're learning that if they have a good corporate culture, people may stay on. They kind of see that. They're also looking at innovative ways and things that are different, and how can we be different and kind of moving on so we're not like a cookie cutter business type of thing. So agriculture is one of them. You know, everybody has t-shirts, but maybe their t-shirts are made with raffia or something else, you know, that's kind of innovated that way. But it's been really tough for the smaller businesses to start. And also lease rents are really high right now. So we are seeing some people who are, we call it the dating game, where you have the kiosk in the mall so they can kind of check to see, is, you know, this the right place? Is this where people want to come and see our goods? And if it is, then, you know, they kind of get married and they get a long-term lease in those places. If it doesn't work up, they kind of break up and they can go someplace else.
Yeah. And are you seeing the kind of innovation that the caller was talking about, but also what you're talking about, these experimental businesses? Who's doing those? I'm curious.
We're seeing a lot of local entrepreneurs who are kind of dabbling into that now. They may have just had an online store, or they may have just gone to craft fairs, and now they're looking to expand a little larger. Some of them have even gone into some of the national stores and gotten some space in there to kind of expand who their customers are and get exposure that way as well.
Interesting. Okay, well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We are speaking today about Hawaii's economy. You can join our discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Ask our guests a question or let us know your thoughts. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the producers of Two American Families, a new Frontline documentary hosted by Bill Moyers. Follows two families from Milwaukee over a 34-year period as they navigate the economic winds of changing times, struggling to keep from sliding into poverty. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters can expect to receive their primary election ballots by July 23rd. Elections.hawaii.gov.
Welcome back. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Yenji Denise, and our guests today are Paul Brubaker, economist and principal of TZ Economics, Tina Yamaki, president of the Hawaii Retailers Association, and Mike Hamasu, researcher and consulting director at Colliers. Mike, I want to build on what Tina was just telling us about that sort of, I think she called it dating for retail, this idea that you would perhaps use a kiosk and then eventually graduate to a full-scale store. What are you seeing? We talked a little bit about the office market, but what are you seeing in terms of malls, strip malls, you know, larger retail spaces?
Absolutely. In fact, the opportunity for them to open up a temporary shop to allow them to test, you know, pedestrian traffic, sales, and so forth, that has been a trend that has been adopted, I guess, statewide at this point. We, you know, witnessed this on the mainland as well, and, you know, that trend is also transferred here to Hawaii. But, you know, what that allows is, you know, the landlord and the tenant to see whether or not, you know, there's an agreement in regards to, well, can I hit the sales levels that I need because they need to pay rent. You know, the landlord is not going to offer anything for free. So ultimately, there is that agreement that if I can hit the certain sales numbers in this temporary store via social media, lots of advertising, so forth, you know, that provides the landlord the opportunity to convert them into a regular paying tenant.
And are you seeing the vacancy? You know, you said that office was stabilizing around 10-13%, depending. Are you seeing similar numbers in traditional retail space?
Yeah, what's surprising is the trends are very similar. Typically, Hawaii's vacancy rate is probably about 3-5%. We've kind of stabilized at 6%, but it has fluctuated dramatically ever since the pandemic. It went up double digits and then it came back down again. Luckily, you know, we're seeing stabilization. We're seeing that the existing anchor tenants are establishing or reestablishing their connection to their clientele, and we're starting to see sales start to kind of flatten out or kind of stabilize to a new equilibrium point in the retail market. So we remain fairly hopeful that that continues, because I know, as Tina will elaborate, the retailers have faced dramatic changes over the last 4 or 5 years, and now we're faced with a labor shortage. You know, those challenges will remain, but hopefully, you know, we'll work our way through this and ultimately find a point where we can remain successful.
There are more people aged 30 to 60 in Hawaii than there are under the age of 30. So to the point Mike just made about the workforce, they weren't born. And evidently, we're not going to allow them to immigrate. So what you see is kind of what you get. Like, it's you can't make babies fast enough to change the challenge of hiring and finding, you know, you need workers that fit. That's the other thing. The skill sets and the activities and occupations have to align. And that's going to make us much more reliant on technology to overcome the workforce gaps. And that's where things like AI start to become interesting and maybe of potential benefit in the absence of physical bodies to do the work.
Mm. Let's go to Charlotte now. She's calling in from Honolulu, and she has a comment about taxes.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling specifically about the fact that Hawaii is the only state that essentially charges sales tax, or DET, on medical services. Recently, there was it was passed that in 2026, we will not have to pay that on Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, but that still leaves every other insurance out there that 4.5% of everything that physicians, medical practices make has to go into taxes. And currently, in regards to our economy, that means we are unable to hire additional staff, expand services, or hire physicians. And as we already know, Hawaii is ridiculously underserved when it comes to the medical community anyway. Maui just had a huge departure of OBGYNs. I personally work in nephrology. There's a huge incidence of kidney disease here, and we constantly have more new patients than we can see. So what do you see happening as far as reducing what I think is an unfair burden on the community and the medical practice to be able to increase that sector of our economy, but also to make it more viable for us to continue to recruit those people to live here and fill those positions? And I will take my comments off air. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And you know, Paul, just to add to that before we toss it to you to take her question, the governor, being a physician himself, has said that he's made this a priority. He's done a lot with loan forgiveness to try to attract more medical personnel to the state. But to her point, what are your thoughts?
Well, there are two points. One has to do with the structure of the tax system, which I'll get to in a second. The second has to do with what's a necessity. And for medical professionals, medical care is a necessity. But for retailers, maybe food is a necessity, or maybe clothing is a necessity. I don't know. And so we'll just have to debate that. Are Twinkies food? Should they be tax-free if food is a necessity? So let's leave that to the side, because I'm going to answer the tax question. Hawaii doesn't have a sales tax. A sales tax is a tax on a thing that is bought or sold, or a service that is bought or sold, like a medical service. Hawaii has a gross receipts tax. That means no matter how you receive the receipt, no matter what economic activity is the source of its origination, you pay the tax. So it's the seller of the service or good, the recipient of the receipt are liable, have the tax liability. And that broad base, because everything's in it, allows for a relatively low rate. Now, states that have a sales tax the things that are sold, and not all things. And so they have this interesting debate about what's a necessity and what's not a necessity. But it's not, ironically, it's not really relevant if you have a gross receipts tax. The other aspect of the GET that makes it desirable in some views is that it's highly exportable. So 30% of the gross receipts tax revenue come from people that aren't in Hawaii because they're tourists. And you could go to a sales tax or you could go to a consumption tax, and those would be big changes and would have, major implications. And then just as a final, maybe as an aside, you need to look at all the legs of the stool, right? Because the gross receipts tax, which is the biggest source of state revenue, about half, a little more than half, is one of the legs. The income tax is another one. We've just talked about how up to $1.5 billion in revenue from that source is going to evaporate over the next 7 or 8 years. And then the third leg of the stool is the real property tax, which is by far the lowest in the country. Don't ask me why. And which, under the constitutional realignment in 1978, became the sole kuleana of the county governments. So the legislature controls the general excise tax rate and structure and coverage and the income tax systemic design. But the counties are in charge of the property tax. So go, it's the blend of all three that creates the tax burden. And if, for example, some of the other handles were more active, other legs of the stool were more actively utilized, it might be possible to be more generous, let's say, with respect to things that plausibly or arguably could be considered more necessary than others, even within the general excise tax context.
I love
nerd,
that.
Nerd fest,
yeah, I think,
on
I think
parade.
We get all the details, and that's why we invite you on. I want to get back to something, Tina, that you were talking about, and that is the difficulty in hiring. Mm-hmm. I was looking at some DBED numbers, and the projection for this entire year, average annual unemployment rate estimated to be 2.8%. We want low unemployment, of course. We want our friends and neighbors to have jobs. At the same time, if you're hiring, it makes it very hard. So what kinds of things are retailers who are operating on very thin margins to begin with doing to attract and retain workers? How creative do they have to be, and how do they do that right now?
They're doing it every possible way that they can find, whether it's on the internet or what they're hearing. What we found out for some local retailers, it's word of mouth. It's like, I work there, so I'm going to tell my friend to come work here or my cousin to come work here because they have such a good time there. It's those retailers that take care of their employees, have a good retention, and also a way of hiring people too. Like some go on picnics or, you know, they have pizza days or something like that. We've heard where there is a bonus if you, you know, bring somebody on and they stay 6 months. They're looking at all different creative ways. And it's hard to get people into retail because people, a lot of people want to work from home. But if I'm at home eating Cheetos and watching Korean dramas and you're at the cash register, I can't check you out. So, I mean, it is a hands-on type of thing that we have to be there. And what we've also found out is during the pandemic, you know, the baby boomers who always said, I'm going to retire next year. Well, they found out staying at home wasn't so bad, so they didn't come back into the workforce. And then there was a bunch of people who left the islands. And then there's some who had a side hustle that found out they can live off of that. And that's where you get like the new pop-ups and retailers. And then there's just another section who just only want to work from home.
And Mike, what does that do then, you know, to the ability of a business to grow and then sign a lease in commercial real estate?
Absolutely. It's a snowball effect. I mean, you know, Tina mentioned how the challenges of retailers trying to find entry-level, you know, shop clerks. Similar in the office environment and in industrial businesses, there's a lot of entry-level positions. So they're all competing in the same pool for this limited amount of resources. So if you can't make an increased hourly wage offer to a prospect, then you're going to lose them. If I can't offer you remote work, I'm going to lose you. I mean, ultimately, you have all these challenges that are thrown at you, which result in, you know, just so much competition for such a small amount of people that, you know, if I were an entry-level person, I'd weigh what would I want, and I'd figure out I could get paid better in this industry versus that industry and, you know, take that job because I get paid more.
Yeah, there's also a difference now in our generation and the generation coming into the workforce. The ones coming in now don't want to work Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They'll tell you what hours they want to work. Doesn't mean that your store is going to be open at that time, but that's the time that they're available.
Ooh, and, sorry,
yeah. And so that makes it even harder. And, you know, they got to take a mental health day and, you know, and all these other things. So it makes it even harder for retailers to hire them. And it doesn't matter at what price. A lot of times.
And Paul, you know, one of the other things that Tina just mentioned was this exodus of workers that we saw after the pandemic, and we lost quite a few people, and Hawaii's population continues to decline. DBED seems to think that that will stabilize and potentially even go to growth. But what impact has that exodus meant for the workforce and for our economy?
Well, some of us are debating with DBED, our good friends at DBED, bless their hearts, whether the population has actually decreased, because some of our colleagues seem not to believe what the data are telling us. But I can, so then the question comes, which data do we trust? Because the data on jobs and employment, or persons employed in jobs, are straightforward. And as I mentioned, 25 or 30,000, depending on whether you count jobs or persons, and 100,000, if you compare to where Hawaii would have been on the path it was on until about 2017. So at some point, Hawaii just turned right. And then this other problem that's already come up before, which is those workers weren't born, the ones we're looking for. They're not there. They weren't born, so you're going to have to deal with it.
Well, did they leave? Are they the ones who left?
Well, as I say, there's a debate about that. The population statistics say that Hawaii's been losing population for 6 or 7 years, which is not a one-off. That's a referendum, and people are voting with their feet, unless you don't believe the data. So if you go look at the state's official forecasts, oh, no, it's all good, it's going up. And I'm like, well, I can see that the jobs are going to range, so I'm supposed to not believe the jobs data. I can see lots of other data that show that the economy is not where it would have been had it just stayed on track. And by the way, the rest of the U.S. economy got right back on track after the pandemic, went all the way, not just to where it was before the pandemic, but to where it would have been had the pandemic never occurred.
So what's different about us?
we're not anywhere near. We're 10% below the pre-pandemic trajectory, which says to me somebody has to leave, right? There's 10% less output, 10% less income. Somebody needs to GTFO, and it better not be me. That's, I'm trying to make clear how serious this is, unless you don't believe it's true, and it's all good, and we'll go have a legislative session and make believe, no problem. No worry, beef curry. So there's a legitimate debate about this. I'm just saying I tend to be a little more on the risk, you know, management side, the risk aversion side of the debate. I think we ought to deal with the possibility that Hawaii's really going down a scary path if it continues to fail to rebuild or restore or, you know, rebound to where it could have been.
Okay. Well, we're going to continue that conversation. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We, of course, are speaking today about Hawaii's economy, and you can join our discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Ask our guests a question or let us know your thoughts. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Support for HPR comes from Ulupono Initiative. By investing and partnering in local food production, Ulupono supports Hawaii's farmers and ranchers who help reduce the risk of wildfires through land management and stewardship.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll talk about art, technology, and culture at FESPAC. We'll talk to Solomon Enos and get a local artist's perspective on FESPAC and how it informs the work he does. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Yenji Denise. Our guests today are economist Paul Brubaker, president of the Hawaii Retailers Association, Tina Yamaki, and Mike Hamasu of Colliers. We are getting close to the one-year anniversary of the Lahaina wildfires, and I'd love to hear from each of you on how you're seeing that impacting your respective sectors of the economy. Tina, let's start with you. I know a number of your members had businesses on Front Street and beyond. What has been the impact for retailers?
For us, the single retailers, I mean, they don't have a business, so they're not a member anymore. A lot of them who came to Hawaii pretty, you know, like within the last five or six years, we found out a lot of them have gone back to the mainland. They might have come back again. Some of them are trying to rebuild. We've had members who lost one business, up to four businesses. So it has impacted them very greatly. Now they're trying to deal with all the insurance. It's not like a homeowner's insurance. When you have a business, there's multiple layers of insurance you got to deal with. So rebuilding is a lot harder. So they're still going through that. And it wasn't just retailers. It was banks lost their business. It was restaurants. It was, you know, a bunch of other people who did too. So we're all kind of trying to rebuild and see if we can come back to Lahaina again.
Yeah, we're expecting a lot of rebuilding. But Mike, you know, one of the challenges, of course, is going to be rebuilding costs because the cost of construction and materials has raised so significantly in the last few years. And also, you know, finding the workers to actually build these areas and the interest rates. What are you expecting to see in commercial real estate specifically with the rebuilding?
Absolutely. I see, you know, significant challenges. One, you mentioned cost of goods, cost of construction materials. They've all escalated. The problem is when you order materials for Maui, you know, that's another shipping expense that you have to incur. The lack of available construction labor, tradesmen, you know, you're seeing firms considering doing business in Maui, but they have to ship all their or transfer all their workforce and their labor to Maui because there is a shortage of available supply of skilled tradesmen. Interest rate environment, very challenging. I mean, you know, at a dramatic from 3% up to 7%, you know, if I had to borrow money to build or rebuild, the challenge is there that it's just not going to pencil. And the higher cost of wages, higher cost of labor, higher cost of construction materials, and also the challenges of getting through government regulation, you know, we've experienced this on Oahu as well, as the Department of Planning and Permitting have gone through significant challenges as well. So that kind of places a significant burden on any landowner or property owner on Maui to even pursue rebuilding, because the challenges there are immense and, you know, tend to hold people back from even moving a step forward.
We want to remind our callers to join our conversation. You can do so by calling 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Paul, we know Lahaina and all that comes with it has had a tremendous impact on the tourism market, and that ripples out across the state. What is your sort of feeling or estimation on what it is going to take or how long it will take for us to fully recover from that?
It's not moving very quickly, and it's a real disappointment. I mean, the tragedy of Lahaina, of course, is that it's you know, I don't know how other to say it than it's a toxic burn pit. And as a consequence, the remediation challenges alone delayed swift recovery. But, of course, the rest of the island is not impaired. And if you wanted to rebuild housing, it could have been done. I'm struck by the fact that on Kauai, after Iniki, which did affect the entire island, 2/3 of all the reconstruction building permits were issued within 4 months of the hurricane. So people didn't have power and water, and they had already gotten building permits issued by an Office of Emergency Permitting that Mayor Joanne Yukimura set up right away after the hurricane. So the response, it's a real contrast in adaptability to an unpredictable shock. By the way, it's unpredictable in the sense that you don't know when it's going to happen or how bad it's going to be, but you know a hurricane is going to happen and you know a wildfire is going to happen. So the difference in the two outcomes, I think, really speaks to this challenge of process as opposed to the cost of labor or the cost of materials. And I have to say I'm also a bit mystified why. I mean, does everybody affected want to be back where they started, or do they want to be somewhere else? And I know their aspirations, for example, to restore part of Lahaina's natural and cultural history to a format that had essentially been paved over. And there are global climate concerns, right? Lahaina's a seawall. I don't understand how you can just go back, and given that the sea is rising and the inundation alone is going to change, you know, the hydrology and geology of that area to begin with. So lots of challenges, and probably the only one that's really remediable is the process part.
And what's interesting also about what you said is that one specific part of Maui, of course, is heavily, heavily impacted,
but the
rest of the island is not. But the perception across the planet, frankly, is that Maui was off limits for a long time, and we have to turn that part around as well.
Well, first mover advantage in social media is do not go to Maui. right? I think that's a direct quote from Aquaman. And so the messaging alone is, right, first message wins. And here we are, the volume is down 25%. But, dude, that's like saying if there's a fire in Nanakuli, you shouldn't go to Waikiki. If there's a fire in Lahaina, you shouldn't go to Wailea. That's just crazy. And so the messaging got out of control from the beginning. You sort of can't roll that back anymore. It's the first time ever that state actors use generative AI in disinformation campaigns. Chinese state actors literally used generative AI to assert that U.S. Defense Department space lasers caused the wildfires. So that's a first. That one goes down in the history.
Well, Tina, I mean, let's draw out from what Paul is saying, this idea of the messaging. Or what are you hearing from retailers on Maui who are not in the burn zone about what their businesses have gone through?
It depends what kind of business you're looking at. If you're a business that caters to local and locals and the visitors, they're doing pretty okay. I mean, their volume is, of course, way down. It's not like what it used to be. Those who catered only to visitors, they are struggling. We're seeing them going, you know, their profits are down. People aren't coming in. But I agree, there has to be some strong messaging that says, Maui is open. Come on back. It's okay to come in. You know, I think that's the message that people need to know. And I think people are so respectful that they don't want to go to Maui while they're still rebuilding and, you know, get in the way and do all of that kind of stuff. And I think Maui Fires was the first one where we saw worldwide where we got stuff from them, you know, help, whether it was monetary or products, services that were coming in. You didn't see that in California or someplace else. So it had a huge impact.
You know, Paul, what strikes me is that our unemployment rate is low. We are growing slowly. We're not in a recession, but our growth is relatively slow. What do you think is our perception of our economy in line with what we're actually experiencing?
Look, you have to resolve in your brain the fact that 98% of people who want to work on Maui or in Maui County have a job. The unemployment rate in Maui is 2%. 98% of people who want to work in Maui have a job. No problem, right? Except for the 5,000 people who haven't worked since last August and the 5,000 people or jobs, I can't remember which it is, who never had their jobs restored after the pandemic. So now we're into 10,000 out of the 80,000 total pre-pandemic. And maybe the 85 or 90,000 it could have been if there had never been a pandemic. And so you just have to be careful to congratulate ourselves because everybody has a job while we ignore the 5, 10, I don't know, 15, 20,000 people who evidently had to have left. Well, how else would they eat? I think it's a big mistake. And we're focusing too much on some things and not on others, like 2,000 houses? Can we build 2,000 houses? Maui built 3,000 houses a year in 1973 and 1974 with slide rules. So it's been done. And why we can't do that now, I just don't understand.
Yeah, Lahaina is its own show, I think, for sure.
Lahaina is symptomatic of much deeper challenges we face as a community, and which even 30 years ago, it's just so striking to look at the Iniki response. All the problems, you know, Mike mentioned, how do the contractors get there? They fly there. They commuted there. Or they stayed in a hotel if they could afford it. And, I mean, we've done this. We in Hawaii have done this. People know how to do this. There's tons of people over there on Maui working to help, engineer the comeback. So don't misunderstand me. It's not like it's being ignored. But there's something about the nature of the event itself and the way our systems simply don't allow us to adapt, that is, to my mind, jamming. A year later, and the story in the newspaper, one guy is building his house because he already had a building permit because the fire came while he was building his house. So, I mean, that's not a model for where we're going.
The hour goes so fast, and it's time now for a final thought from each of our guests. You know, we invited you here today to talk about the state of Hawaii's economy. So I go back to where we started, and Tina, start with you. The prospects for small business owners, of course, you represent the Hawaii Retailers Association. From your vantage point, how are we doing economically?
I think for retailers, we are all struggling. We've seen the downturn in tourism. Their numbers are just not there. Lease rents are coming up. Higher wages are coming up here in January. And a lot of these retailers took out loans during the pandemic to keep their doors open and their employees employed. And they're just not knowing how to pay for that. So we may see a lot more businesses closing come the beginning of the year again, which is really sad. And, you know, for all of us, support our local retailers, whether it's a local retailer or it's even a national retailer, because a lot of the local retailers or local businesses have something in there, and they all hire our friends, family, and neighbors in there too. So support retail here in Hawaii.
Yeah, and Mike, you know, what Tina is talking about has a direct impact on your industry as well. From where you sit, how is our economy?
I guess I would be the person in the middle of the road, because I've seen it from an office perspective, which has been devastated by hybrid work environment. I've seen it from the retail perspective, where, you know, you've had dramatic changes because of the pandemic. The benefit has been in the industrial sector, where you've had dramatic changes, where, you know, the paradigm shift from buying stuff in a store to actually going e-commerce has actually benefited the industrial sector. So if I were to leave you with a statement, I'd say resiliency has always been the case in terms of Hawaii. I think we're coming out of a tunnel at this point, and we're hopefully going to see a light pretty soon. I mean, fingers crossed based on maybe what Paul has said. But ultimately, what I hope for is that we achieve a new stabilization and we actually hit an equilibrium point where we actually can start growing after that.
And Paul, do you share that optimism?
Yeah, you know, I want to end on at least not a negative note. We have stabilized. You see that in a number of interesting statistics. For example, the proportion of the workforce that works hybrid or remotely full-time has stabilized in Hawaii at about 25% of the workforce. That's a really interesting new kind of economy from the one we had before, and something we can, you know, work on building forward from. So to Mike's point, we have seen the worst, where things are sort of falling into place, and now it's on us to push forward and dig out, if we can, a little more from the hole that we have and maybe catch up to the rest of the country.
Okay, it's on us. Thank you so much. We want to thank our guest, Paul Brubaker, economist and principal of TZ Economics, Tina Yamaki, president of the Hawaii Retailers Association, and Mike Hamasu, researcher and consulting director at Colliers. And of course, we thank you, our listeners, for joining us on today's show. Tomorrow, we'll have another live call-in program to talk about kids and smartphones. 42% of American children have a smartphone by the age of 10. By 14, that number jumps to 91%. What are the impacts of these devices on academics, personal relationships, mental health, and play? Please do join us for that. Have a comment to share about today's show? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Got a story you want to share? Leave that feedback on our talkback line as well, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere you tune in. I'm Yanji Denise. Be sure to join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.